And welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, more than a dozen Philadelphia police officers will be fired in connection with controversial Facebook posts that were published in an online database. We'll explore the correlation between the officers who made those posts and the number of civilian complaints lodged against them. And later, it's a green collar revolution in Delaware. We'll hear from the entrepreneur whose new vertical farm will be staffed almost entirely by former inmates. But we begin with Code Red. The city of Philadelphia remains under a heat health emergency through tonight, following a weekend of sweltering temperatures and heat indexes in the triple digits. The city quadrupled its outreach to the homeless, with workers fanning out to offer cool shelter and cold drinks. So how do the 1,000-plus people living on Philadelphia streets survive a massive heat wave? And what can government and individuals do to help? Bridget Tobler is here to take us behind the scenes of the city's homeless outreach effort when temperatures reach dangerously high levels, as they did over the weekend. Bridget is homeless outreach manager for the City of Philadelphia. And Bridget, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So what exactly is a Code Red? What kind of changes go into effect when that happens?
So Code Red is like two consecutive days of 95 degrees or higher temperature, along with we look at the heat index and the air quality. So a collaborative team of the Office of Homeless Services, DBH, and Outreach Coordination Center calls the Code Red, which then triggers the teams to increase their contacts, give out more water, do assessments for heat-related issues, and ideally to get them indoors and offer them shelter and treatment or whatever is appropriate for each case.
And then just to clarify, what's the difference between a Code Red and a heat health emergency? Is there a difference between those two things?
That I don't know. I think it's the temperature might be a little bit different or lower.
Okay. Talk about what the workers actually do when they begin to fan out and look for homeless people to help. What is their responsibility at that point, or what is their goal?
So I always kind of explain the homeless outreach teams has kind of three tiers. One, they're doing the response calls, which are through the hotline. We have a 24-hour hotline. It's 215-232-1984. Anyone can call, concerned citizens can call and give the location of the person, a description, and then our teams will go out and assess. Along with that, they also work a zone. So an area that each team kind of hits on an ongoing basis to engage people, develop rapport with the homeless population. And then they also have a focus list. So it's kind of like their caseload that they check in on people. So we feel like that the combination of those three is where kind of the magic happens, the ongoing engagement, trust and rapport, and hopefully offering them services so when they're ready, they say yes, and we know them, and we know what they need.
Well, that raises a couple of questions, Bridget, because I have heard that, as in wintertime, there are a significant number of people who refuse shelter, who refuse air conditioning, who may even refuse cold drinks. Why is that?
Well, the homeless population, about 85% of those on the that are on the street that are chronically homeless suffer from some behavioral health issues. So with that, they don't really always have the ability, or they're impaired, to gauge their heat tolerance. So we kind of have to do that for them, talk to them about, please drink some water, get in the shade, unlayer. You know, a lot of our people will layer their clothes because that's all their belongings, and keeping it close to them is what they're used to doing. So we have to do a lot of encouraging around that. And if they're not able to care for themselves, or we find that they have an inability to care, then we would pursue a 302 to get them in the hospital and the treatment they need.
So that a 302 would be sort of forcing them and
it's an,
someone
it's
picking
involuntary
them up to take
commitment.
Them?
Or? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's always our last defense. We won't walk away from someone if we think that they would die out there. So we always try to offer any other options that we can get them in. What are you willing to get in, to do? And that's always our last intervention.
You mentioned the word trust, which is really important, and I'm wondering how workers do that. How do they establish trust with the people that they are trying to help so that when, you know, we have a code red or a code blue in the cold weather, there's enough of a level of trust there for them to maybe be more willing to receive the help?
I think it's just, some simple things of just treating people with dignity and respect and kindness, saying hello. When I talk to some of, I always ask people who come off the streets what outreach did to help that process. And they all have the same answer, which is very interesting to me. It's like, no matter what, they always came to me. They always asked me, if I wanted services. Sometimes I would curse them out or treat them not nice, and they always came back, and they were always available. So when I was ready, they had that relationship. They knew that we weren't giving up on them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really kind of the key to that, just not giving up, always having hope in them.
I want to remind our listeners and invite them to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Bridget, no doubt you have seen for yourself and heard a lot of stories, both from the homeless people, as you just mentioned, but from the workers who go out. I was thinking this weekend when, the temperature hit 98, 99 degrees. The heat index was, 112 or just something astronomical. And thinking about how in the world people survive being outside all the time. And I wonder, what do people see? What are some of the stories that you hear from people who come back who are working with the homeless under those conditions? What are they seeing out there?
They will engage people. Some people are willing to come in. Some may go find shelter like under a shade. They are a little bit sometimes more eager or willing to come into whatever services we have. We did have a lot of placements this weekend, people coming in, people accepting lots of water. We gave out a lot of water this weekend. People going to the hospitals or being transported to evaluations for treatment. And then we always have, we always have that population that will continue to say no, but we continue to ask and we don't give up on them.
What are the signs that your workers look for, and also that just, the rest of us can be looking for to know when someone may be in danger from the heat?
If they're layered up, if they have many layers of clothes, if they're in the climate, sitting, in the heat, won't take water. A lot of times, if we will ask them to unlayer, if they say no, then that kind of that worries us more. Just trying to, if you see somebody out there who's layered, they got summer, winter clothes on the middle of the thing, sometimes they might be disoriented, sweating. That's kind of how we kind of assess. If we can get them to unlayer and whatever we can do to get them in and in the shade, take the water, or ultimately go into shelter.
I was reading about cooling centers as well that have been available to people. What are they and how do people find them?
The city does list the cooling centers. Many of them are libraries, and I think there's senior centers have cooling centers also. I think the city does list all of them, and we share them with the teams to give them as another option for people. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to go into shelter, if they don't want to go into treatment or what have you, then we would offer them the cooling stations in the areas that they tend to hang.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like you did overall this weekend in terms of getting people off the streets, at least getting them water? I mean, how would you assess how the weekend went?
I think the weekend went well. We did. This is when outreach shines. We really were preparing all week for this weekend, trying to think of where we could squeeze extra beds, where there are gaps in the system, and getting extra teams on. People just, they step up. They know that our people are at risk, and they get out there. We had an adequate water, ice, and teams hitting all the locations, the hot spots, as much as we could. And I'm really proud of their work this weekend. They did a great job. A lot of teamwork between the outreach teams and then the Office of Homeless Services.
I know that your work obviously centers around the homeless, Bridget, but there has also been concern about pets, and the city has, you know, had some things to say about that. What about pets, and what does the Code Red mean for that for them?
Pets is always a barrier for us around just housing options, but we actually did have a plan for people who did have pets and wanted to come in. We did have a resource available just in case, because we always, pets and couples tend to be where we have the least amount of resources, or sometimes a reason why people don't want to come in. They don't want to leave each other. They don't want to leave their pet. So we try to provide options so that's not an issue. You know, it's like, we got it. You know, we'll figure it out. Come on in. And we did prepare for that this week.
Yeah. What about ordinary citizens, Bridget? You know, what can people do if they see a homeless person or even, you know, a pet outdoors in a heat wave like what we have seen? What can people do if they're concerned that, you know, there might be an issue here? I know that you gave the hotline number, and I'll mention that, 215-232-1984, right?
Yeah.
But what else can people do if someone looks like they're in distress, just looks like they need to get out of the heat? What do you recommend?
I mean, I recommend, you know, if they look like they're in physical distress where it might need to be a call to 911, I would encourage that. If not, calling the hotline would be the best. We'll go out, we'll assess. Giving people a bottle of water when you walk by, just saying hello to them. But I really like the idea of calling into the hotline. You give a description and a location. We rely on the public for their help and concern. Sometimes it might be an area that we don't know. So it could get somebody on our radar and it could save lives.
Yeah. What's been the hardest part, Bridget, for you in doing this job, in working with the homeless and trying to protect them in these very harsh conditions, especially when there may not always be a willingness to be helped? What's the most difficult thing for you?
You know, I guess when you hear no a lot, it can get to the teams. But, you know, we are, I always say that the outreach workers are kind of, you know, the ambassador of hope, that we don't give up on them and we keep on trying. So, and then also the other thing is like just trying to troubleshoot when people do raise their hand, to make sure that the process of them going in is as smooth as it can go for them, and as respectful as it can go for them. So that way, you know, it's a permanent road to breaking the cycle of homelessness. So it's always trying to, like, think of all the little things to make that process easy is probably where I spend a lot of my time.
Yeah. Well, once again, that hotline number is 215-232-1984. Bridget Tobler, we need to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand and get some ideas on how the rest of us can be of help. And we certainly hope that you stay cool today. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you. Thanks so much.
We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisek in for Mary Cummings Jordan. A number of Philadelphia police officers have been suspended with intent to dismiss over their controversial Facebook posts that were published in an online database last month. 72 officers were assigned to desk duty as part of a broader departmental investigation into hundreds of racist, misogynistic, anti-Muslim, and other offensive posts on social media. In all, more than 300 active duty officers appeared in that database compiled by the Plain View Project. Turns out that a number of the officers have also had civilian complaints lodged against them. WHYY and Billy Penn, our partner news organization, obtained exclusive access to the disciplinary records of almost all of the officers involved in the Facebook scandal. WHYY's Ryan Briggs and Billy Penn's Max Marin have been working together on this story, and they join us now with the latest. Ryan Briggs is a WHYY investigative reporter. Max Marin is political editor for Billy Penn. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
And let me just remind our listeners to join the conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or call us 888-477-9499. Ryan Briggs, the release of these records is unprecedented. How were you able to get them?
To be honest, I mean, it was a fairly straightforward information request to the police department. And, you know, we've filed similar requests in the past for individual officers that might have been involved in a shooting or, you know, some other kind of misconduct. This is the first time that we requested so many records. This is 309 disciplinary records that we received. I think we'd asked for 320. And I would like to say that we did something special to get them, but I think it really owes more to what's going on with the department right now in regards to this scandal, you know, that's centered around the release of these Facebook posts and the database that was published last month. And so I think that the department just felt more of an imperative to release the records.
Yeah. Max, what would you say were some of the big takeaways from those records?
The analysis that we did showed that some of the officers in this cohort of cops who were flagged in this Plainview Project database received a far higher number of civilian complaints than the average city cop. And this is based off of some previous reporting we've done around civilian complaints lodged against police officers in Philadelphia. But overall, the officers, you know, they did tend to get, you know, in general, this body of officers did tend to get a just slightly higher number of complaints than the police department as a whole. But again, we're dealing with just a selective, you know, body of officers that are flagged in this thing. And there's not really a clear association between them, aside from saying that, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's definitely this large body of them that have gotten a larger number of complaints.
And it sounds like it was roughly half, would you say, that also had civilian complaints
of some sort?
Yeah.
It was about half, I think, something like maybe a little bit more than a third of the department as a whole got, you know, at least one civilian complaint over the past 5 years. So that's a third for just all cops. The cops that were in these posts that some have said, you know, are racist, violent, whatever, it was closer to 50%. So it was, you know, a bit of an elevated, you know, number of complaints there. And some of the officers, a handful of those officers, you know, had gotten upwards of 15, 16 complaints in just the last 5 years. So that's like, you know, you're averaging a civilian complaint, you know, every couple of months, compared to the average police officer that maybe gets, you know, one in every couple of years.
Yeah. What kind of complaints, Matt, are we talking about here?
I mean, they run the gamut from just these kind of minor departmental violations, just anything that like HR might flag you for not following protocol, to more serious allegations about physical abuse, criminal misconduct. Now, keep in mind, these are just allegations in each one of them. The city does release these records as of 2 years ago. They started to release the outcomes of these civilian complaints. So you can anybody can go and see, you know, what the, if they have the complaint number, if they have the description, to go look for it and find, you know, what the outcome is. You know, often the internal affairs is ruling on these matters internally, and they make a decision that says, you know, there was this allegation, we didn't find anything to sustain it, and so on. So each one of these, you know, cases, you know, there were a certain number of them that were sustained, but, you know, by and large, generally across the police department, most of these complaints are not sustained by internal affairs.
There was one officer, Ryan, that seemed to kind of top the list when it came to the number of complaints. What do we know about him?
Well, I, you know, the officers that we've looked at that have kind of topped the list, and the officers, you know, that are maybe going to face some serious repercussions. You know, we don't always know who's who, right? The department hasn't released the full names of the officers that they're firing now, but we do know that, you know, at least a couple of the officers that they were investigating over these Facebook posts, you know, had gotten upwards of, you know, 20 some complaints, and what I think we saw in the pattern, like the individual you're talking about, is that there would be repeat allegations alleging, you know, physical abuse, complaints alleging kind of a pattern of thefts. And I think when you start to see patterns, you know, again, as Max said, these are only allegations. A lot of the complaints aren't sustained. But when you see that pattern over and over again, I think even a lot of police officers would say, that's a little weird. That's a little suspicious that you would kind of see all of these different individuals lodging these very similar complaints. And so that's kind of the pattern that you see with the guys who are sort of at the top of the heap here. And I think the bigger question maybe to get at is, you know, why is nothing really happening, you know, as a result of that? Why are we only talking about this now because of, you know, some Facebook posts that went up instead of these formal complaints.
Right. There are 13 that I understand are in line to lose their jobs as a result of this. Are they likely to get their jobs back eventually?
I mean, the history of this is that, you know, the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, you know, has historically gone to bat for officers that the commissioner seeks to fire. Not always, but in the majority of cases, and I would say I've anecdotally at least seen cases that seem more serious than this, you know, controversy over Facebook posts where the union said, we're going to try to, you know, stand up for this guy and get his job back. So I would say that the likelihood is very high that if some of the officers that are among those who are going to be fired, you know, want to contest the firing, that the FOP would probably go to bat for them and, you know, has a strong track record of succeeding in getting officers put back on the force.
Do we know how the FOP is responding at this point, or kind of have they hinted at
they said they were disappointed by the firing?
Yeah, I mean, well, the police union, first of all, the police union, you know, to their credit, has, you know, widely and consistently condemned a lot of the material that they've seen in the posts, which is some, you know, in a lot of ways a little more forward of them based off of their past, you know, responses to certain incidents, which is kind of unequivocal defense of police officers. They've said some of this content is just unacceptable. Officers can't be talking like this. But at the same time, they're saying that firings resulting from any of these Facebook posts would be kind of completely unreasonable. And they've already indicated that they're going to go forward with arbitration.
If the officers want to contest the fire.
And then what about the others? So 13 are scheduled to be fired, but then there were 72 who were taken off the streets. So what happens to the rest?
Yeah, so Ross said that all of the officers, I think, may have already had to attend some kind of a training. And I believe he said that there would be additional retraining in, you know, for everyone that was involved. There's a smaller group that will face suspensions ranging from, I think, 5 days to 30 days. All of the officers that are set to be fired, I believe, are currently being put on a 30-day suspension with the intent to fire. There's another unknown group that is going to be suspended just for 30 days, will not be fired. And then there is another group, again, still unknown the exact quantity, that I think gets benched for 5 days or something like that. Yeah.
Matt, as the department was going through all of these posts, I mean, there's hundreds of them. Sorry, Max, forgive me. Max Marin from Billy Penn. Max, as the department was going through these posts, I mean, there are hundreds of them. How do they distinguish between those that are protected by the First Amendment and those that are a firing offense?
I think the first thing to remind our listeners is that this is a database compiled by some attorneys, one of whom is based in Philadelphia, and it's based off of, you know, their social understanding of what is an offensive or what is a violent or misogynistic or racist Facebook post on social media. Now, Ryan and I have, you know, gone through these posts, I think nearly every single one of them from the Philadelphia police officers, and clearly a lot of it is just, you know, chatter. It is just you know, just some, you know, and the police union used the phrase, like, you know, cops being cops and venting. Now, like, on the other hand, there is a large body of these posts that, like, are sort of unequivocally vitriolic and, you know, accusatory and discriminatory in a lot of ways, or advocating for violence. The posts themselves, I mean, we don't really have any understanding of how the police department is using their own judgment, but I'm only using this framework to say that, you know, you have to analyze it on your own framework, and basically the department is doing that now internally, we presume.
I mean, the department retained Ballard Spahr, which is a law firm, to independently review the posts.
Right.
And on the basis of that, the commissioner says they came up with these determinations to have some fired, some suspended, some, you know, retrained. But I think for, you know, a lot of guys on the force, I think for a lot of independent observers, they would look at that and say, well, you know, what was the metric that they used?
Right.
You know, how do you determine who gets 5 day suspension versus 30 days versus they lose their job? And I think, and again, this is on both sides of this, which is important to remember. Like, I've heard from cops who were frustrated, who said, you know, that this isn't fair, like that they kind of just picked sort of, you know, not like a completely random group of people, but that there were maybe more people that were on that line who didn't get, you know, the kind of ultimate sort of punishment that the department's meeting out here, but maybe, you know, should have on if you're just basing it on the content of some Facebook posts. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say, I think.
Yeah. Got an email here from Bernie. Not a question, just a comment. He says, Commissioner Ross's feigning ignorance of this kind of problem either demonstrates he's willfully uninformed about police culture or lying to the public. Pretty strong statement from Bernie. What have you been hearing, either of you? As you've been out covering the story, you've been talking to people. What's the feedback that you're hearing about all of this?
Well, like I was saying, I think that there's frustration amongst police officers. I've heard similar comments from people who say, of course, you know, the like higher ranking officers, you know, knew about this. I would say, you know, even us as reporters knew about this. And maybe this says something about the culture of reporting in Philadelphia, that you kind of knew that there were these cops who would go out there and post stuff like this. And you just kind of thought, well, I guess that's what cops do. What the commissioner says is, you know, that they didn't have sophisticated enough data mining to understand the scope of this problem. And I think there are a lot of people, you know, again, on and off the force who say that that's kind of, you know, ridiculous. So there is sort of, I think the reaction has been that there's surprise that they're actually firing people. There's also people who I think look at the whole situation and think it's a little absurd. So it sort of runs the gamut.
Yeah. Max, what is the department doing? And I don't know, maybe this is better directed to Ryan, but you may know this as well. Beyond pulling officers off the streets, firing some of them, suspensions, et cetera, what are they talking about in terms of ways to prevent a scandal like this from happening again? Has there been discussion around that at all?
I think the favorite term is a sensitivity training or it's kind of these big blanket trainings. I mean, there's been talk about bringing in a firm to an outside firm to kind of, you know, talk about bias training and anti-bias training to all of the officers involved in the scandal. It might be department-wide. I'm not really sure about the details yet. But this is a very predictable response from any government agency that is kind of embroiled in this, like, sort of racialized otherwise, like, you know, really loaded scandal like this. It's just to say we're going to train everybody, we're going to talk to them about, you know, their implicit and explicit biases, and then that'll be kind of the blanket treatment for everyone.
I think Ross had said something about, you know, kind of developing their own procedures for trying to track this stuff in the future. But then it gets into, I think, the bigger question here, which is, like, you know, if you just are clamping down on these public posts, you know, are you really addressing the issue here? You know, mm-hmm. The thing that people are really worked up about isn't actually just that these posts exist and were visible somewhere. It's that the posts are reflective of larger biases, right? Biases that police might have against the people that they're supposed to protect. There's a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric in there. There was, you know, homophobic statements in there. And people say, you know, if you're supposed to be protecting these people, how can your officers do that effectively? And so if the department, you know, comes up with a way to just sort of put a lid on the public nature of these posts, does that really address the core problem here? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's any easy answers to this.
I'm going to add just one thing. I mean, the attention that this scandal has gotten is kind of, I mean, it's outsized compared to everything else that's going on in the police department. There's an ongoing lawsuit against the police department right now by the Guardian Civic League, the Association of Black Police Officers, alleging widespread racial discrimination within the narcotics unit and other units in the department, and that the top brass is aware of it, that these things are going on. There's ongoing lawsuits, and there's several lawsuits going on right now. I mean, and every year there is another instance of something going on that kind of just shows you, again, that these are just symptoms of a larger issue within the department. I mean, there is racist graffiti found in police department locker rooms, like, you know, directed at other officers. There have been countless examples, small incidents over the years.
We talked about the disciplinary records, I believe, in the initial reporting on this database that went up. A very large proportion of the officers had been named in federal lawsuits, civil rights complaints, allegations of police brutality. I mean, these are, you know, federal suits are pretty serious. Some of them were settled out of court, you know, so there's this implication that maybe something did actually happen here. And I asked the commissioner, you know, why was that not kind of acted upon, right? Again, you have this picture that starts to come into focus here, right? You have officers with these unusually high numbers of civilian complaints. You have officers who are being sued in court over the misconduct. Now we have these sort of publicly embarrassing Facebook posts, and then the department reacts. And I said, you know, why didn't you react earlier? And, you know, there's not really an answer there. And so it kind of comes back to this thing of, you know, well, the department wants to look like it's reacting now because this is this public embarrassing scandal. But maybe it's more about kind of that image than really getting at the root of this problem, right, which is being proactive about getting problematic officers off of street duty.
Well, and exactly, because you can do all the tolerance training you want, but if it's a heart issue, if it's something that's deeply ingrained in a person, to your point, you know, you can maybe learn to put a lid on it, but it doesn't necessarily make it go away. And I don't know, you know, whether the department is even able to, you know, addressing something at that level. But it does raise a question, perhaps even about hiring and whether, you know, it might change hiring processes going forward.
You know, we've talked about this in the newsroom, but I believe that the lieutenant that's in charge of recruiting for the PPD right now, you know, was a captain who oversaw some of the sort of worst offenders, you know, that we had talked about in our prior reporting, who had been involved in a past narcotics scandal. And this is, you know, the guy that's in charge of bringing on, you know, new cadets and things like that. So when you see stuff like that, you start to ask questions about how seriously the department is taking, you know, the bigger picture here, the deeper questions here.
Yeah. Want to read a comment from Brian, who says, at least this leaves a digital footprint, which will lead to transparency. Wearing a police uniform is a privilege, not a right. We need to hold them to a higher standard. So that is a comment from Brian. And we are just about out of time, but I want to thank both of you, Ryan Briggs, Max Marin from Billy Penn. Ryan, of course, is one of our own investigative reporters here at WHYY. For the work that you have done on this story, we will continue to watch to see how all of this unfolds. But thanks to both of you for being on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. It is a green-collar revolution, and it's coming to Wilmington, Delaware. The first state is about to get its first vertical farm. It's an indoor, LED-lit hydroponic farm where the produce will be grown almost entirely by former inmates. The plan is for the employees to eventually become entrepreneurs with vertical farms of their own. Now, the idea was inspired by a couple of TED Talks. It's the brainchild of TEDx Wilmington organizer and self-described serial entrepreneur Ajit George. He joins us now to tell us more about how it will work and who it will benefit. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And Ajit George, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us exactly what vertical farming is.
So the best way to think of a vertical farm is to think of essentially going inside a building, typically an older warehouse. It could be an office building. It has there is no natural light, so it has a traditional roof. It's not a greenhouse, and it grows vertically. So in our first farm, we plan to have 8 levels of racks, for the lack of a better word, that will have plants growing, all of them with LED lights. And basically, we grow it 365 days a year, so we are not dependent on weather temperature or any natural disaster. So it is grown indoor, it is grown locally, and it can grow food in our own, each of our communities. That's the best way to describe a vertical farm.
And what kinds of produce will you be able to grow?
You can grow a huge variety of stuff, but what we initially focus will be on leafy greens, which would be everything from lettuce to kale to basil to mustard greens. We can grow strawberries in the winter. We would make sense to grow it in the summer. You could grow tomatoes. We will focus initially on six crops, and the way we will focus on them is we will go to our end users, which are typically restaurants or grocery stores, and find out what the demand is. And we only will grow where there is a demand. And we will essentially grow to their specs and harvest every week. And so essentially, while I might want to grow cilantro, because I like cilantro, if the demand is not there for cilantro, we will not grow it.
So have you already lined up restaurants, grocery stores, and the
We have lined up a whole bunch of restaurants who are interested. Restaurants are very friendly. As probably the friendliest industry to people who are returning citizens, which is our term for people who have served their time and come out. And so they want to be helpful, but they're also, many of the restaurants are very concerned about food miles, which is a concept of buying within 150 miles, some cases 50 miles from their restaurant. And what we are able to do is to avoid the carbon footprint that invariably comes from food served on the East Coast that comes from California or Mexico or elsewhere. And it's also, more importantly, it's freshly and nutrient. So we are competing on price. Basically, it's the same price that they would have paid for organic food from another supplier, except those suppliers typically are shipping long distance. And so, and that's why we are an attractive source. And there's also another benefit. We're able to guarantee the same price 365 days a year. So typically now, if you're buying lettuce in the summer, it is going to be lower in some cases than the winter. And if there is a E. coli break or a drought or a flood in some of the major agriculture sections in California, the price spikes. What we are able to say is you can buy us and we'll guarantee you that all 52 weeks, the price will be exactly the same because we are not prone to any of the outside weather conditions that would happen because of our indoor facility.
Well, it sounds like it checks an awful lot of boxes. This one in Wilmington will be called Second Chances Farm. I'm wondering how you came up with this idea of hiring returning citizens to staff it.
Well, it really came out of two TEDx talks that occurred at a TEDx event that I organized in 2016. One happened to be given by somebody who had spent 15 years in prison, came out, and really was assured that with second chances he could be a functioning and well-respected citizen. And another one was somebody who had started an urban farm. And it occurred to me that perhaps we could deal with the cycle of recidivism by creating vertical farms in areas that are economically depressed. And this was a relatively new industry. It did not require some of the skills that people returning from prisoners don't have for other jobs. They didn't, and it could also be, they could be trained. And so it was really around finding an answer to the recidivism problem. You know, in the U.S. right now, there's 2.3 million people in prison. We have only 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the prison population. And in Delaware, 70% of the people who are leaving prison within 3 years are rearrested.
70%.
That's a significant recidivism rate. And when you consider that in 2017, the average cost to keep somebody in a Delaware prison was $43,000. That's a very expensive answer. So our goal is to chip away at the recidivism rate by offering an economic opportunity to people who otherwise would not have it. And by essentially focusing exclusively on this group of people, we're not discriminating against them. We're welcoming them and giving them the training that they need to be successful.
Well, you've raised a bunch of questions there, Ajit, and I was really struck by that 70% figure of recidivism that you quoted. Is there a way to project what kind of impact these kinds of vertical farms, for instance, could have on recidivism, what you maybe expect to get that number down to?
So there are, to the best of our knowledge, we're the only vertical farm in the United States that is exclusively focusing on this population. So we have no benchmarks, but there is a benchmark for a different program. There's a program that I'm emulating in, that is in San Quentin Prison, started in San Quentin, California, called the Last Mile Program. And what they did is they worked with inmates for up to 1 year before they left the prison and taught people who had never even touched a computer coding skills. And so they were essentially teaching people from scratch how to become programmers. So when they got out, they had a skill. 25% of the folks on an average dropped out of their program during their training program, and the 75% who graduated and came out of prison got a job. What is interesting is neither the 75% that graduated nor the 25% drop had a 0% recidivism rate up after almost 8-9 years
wow.
of their program. So what it is about hope, mentorship, training. I don't expect to be at zero. I think that is be very hard. But if I can reduce the 70% rate to 35%, I would consider myself exceptionally successful. For each person we avoid having them go back to prison, we're also not only helping themselves, but we're helping their children, their family, their parents, and also helping to create role models within the communities that they live in.
So how will, you mentioned the Last Mile Project, how will these returning citizens be trained and prepared to become essentially vertical farmers?
Well, we start with a very vigorous intake program, a reentry program, which will be run by Saad Solomon, who actually gave the TEDx talk that inspired me. He has a nonprofit called Pierce Mentoring Center in Delaware. So everyone will have to go through a vigorous reentry program, which includes anchor management, time management, all kinds of things that you don't have, that were not addressed in prison, including addiction issues, which a lot of people have. And once he certifies them as being ready to work and his intake workers, we then put them through a 12-month entrepreneur in residence program. And what does that mean? We pay $15 an hour for doing this entrepreneur in residence. We intentionally call it entrepreneurs in residence because we are not trying to just have an employee. We actually are not looking for somebody just to be a farmer. We want them to learn how to be an entrepreneur, how to be successful. Because at the end of 12 months, if they graduate, they become agripreneurs. That's our sort of nickname for what happens when they leave the entrepreneur in residence program. At which point, we no longer pay them $15 an hour. We actually offer them equity, and we offer them a chance to have a profit-sharing plan, and they will get to pick the section of the farm that we have to actually run as a co-op farmer. So our whole program is based on creating entrepreneurs, not employees.
Wow.
And that's the key for us. And our goal is to have 10 farms in the next several years, and our ability to do 10 farms is based on us having successful agripreneurs who succeed and graduate from our entrepreneurship in residence program.
So it sounds like they'll start off, they'll make $15 an hour. Once they get through all the training and all the prep and they're actually working, they'll make $15 an hour. But then obviously the goal is for them to become agripreneurs, to use your term, in their own right. I'm wondering, Ajit, about the challenges that you may have faced in getting this off the ground. I mean, this is quite an innovation, and no doubt there were some hurdles that were in your way. What were some of the challenges in getting this going?
The biggest hurdle is the one that I didn't anticipate. Turns out vertical farms are illegal in most cities. So the city zoning laws in most states and cities prohibit farming in the city. It goes back to the turn of the century last year when they didn't want people bringing chickens and other things into the cities. So we found ourselves that it was illegal, particularly in the city of Wilmington, to have a vertical farm. And thanks to the support of city council, city planning council, and the mayor, and over 9 months of work, we were able to get a zoning code amended to explicitly allow in certain zoning districts the indoor vertical farms. So that's one we surely didn't anticipate, because we thought, well, how hard is it? Such a wonderful cause. But wonderful causes don't often collide with zoning privileges. And then the second one is one that we did not think through, which is really we have found a location where we're going to have a 50,000 square foot farm. It happens to be within 500 feet of a school. And what we have learned is if you are a sex offender, you cannot work or be near 500 feet of the school. So we will have to find those folks a different location in a second farm or a third farm, but they won't be able to come in and work in our first facility because it's within 500 feet of a farm. It's that off the school. So it's those kinds of things that are not glaringly obvious. And then there are obviously the obvious issues of raising capital, the scale of the project. We are essentially creating plant factories. I mean, we have made a decision to invest in opportunity zones, which are essentially designated under the new tax bill as economically depressed areas. So we had to find buildings that were suitable. So we are trying preferably to find older buildings that are unused so we can breathe new life into those buildings and also reinvigorate the communities. Those, of course, offer challenges because they're not often well maintained. So we have to make sure that it's appropriate for us. But we think by being in an older building in a community that has been economically depressed, we're also providing a source of hope in that community.
So it sounds like this idea started percolating, I think you said 2016, with these TEDx talks that you heard. So we're at 2019 now. So what is the rollout timeframe for all of this?
We are hoping to occupy our first building, meaning physically we have, if all things work out, we hope to occupy the building on August 16th, which is less than a month away. And then it'll take us the rest of the year to retrofit the building and get all the equipment in. And we expect to have plants growing by Christmas. My Christmas morning gift, I hope this year, is to have plants growing in this farm. And just to give you an idea, we're only going to take about 14,000 square feet of the 50,000 square foot building to grow our first farm. And at any given point, we will have about 370,000 plants growing, which will get harvested in four weekly increments. So it's a pretty large scale, but we hope to have the first set of plants by Christmas Day.
That is a huge undertaking. And then how many returning citizens will you have coming on board initially?
For every 10,000 square feet, we hope to have between 10 and 15 employees, and that's a function of what kind of crop we grow. Lettuce requires less people, but it's less profitable. Basil requires more people, but it's much more profitable. So it'll be a blended group, and depends on how our farms get growing. And so, and it also depends on the demand for the crops that we have.
Ajit, in our final 60 seconds here, I'd love for you to just articulate your overall vision for what this could be. I mean, you're about to kick it off in another month or so, and as we said, it checks a lot of boxes here. But if you had in a minute or less to articulate what's your ultimate vision for this, what would it be?
Well, our vision would be a Second Chances Farms mission is to nurture plants and people and our planet one green thumb at a time. We will provide returning citizens with mentorship programs and green-collar jobs at hydroponic indoor vertical farms in economically distressed communities. And our vision is twofold: to reduce our carbon footprint by growing food locally 365 days a year, while replacing recidivism with compassionate capitalism and turning entrepreneurs in residence into agripreneurs.
Well, it sounds like it has the potential to be a win-win across the board, and we wish you the best with it. We're so thankful that you've taken a few minutes to talk with us and help us understand what vertical farming is and how Second Chances Farm will work, and we wish you the very best as you kick it off next month.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Our producers are John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer has been Diana Martinez. Thanks for listening.